This time, we look for the picture of God in the Gospel of Matthew. I could have said the first gospel in the New Testament. That would be true in the listing, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, though he may well have been the second or the third, we don't know. And that kind of question is not a major question with us. The fundamental question always is, what picture of God do you see in here? Now, having all read it, would you say that the picture of God is clearer in the New Testament thus far than it was in the Old? Is the picture the same? Does Jesus in person contradict the Old Testament? Does he seem to correct the Old Testament in any way? One thing to help us is we have more versions. More people translated the New Testament than the Old, and certainly more than did the entire Bible. And one of my favorites is now available, Phillips. We did look at Phillips for the four prophets, you remember. But his New Testament, I think, is simply superb. Now, he's long gone now, but his version lives on. You can get it in his original edition or in a revised edition. I see I brought the original with me here. He made about 2,000 changes. He hadn't anticipated that his very free, I don't mean that in a bad sense, his very idiomatic, readable translation would be analyzed and preached about word for word, the way some tend to use the scriptures. And so he thought he should tighten it up a little bit, and he made about 2,000 changes in his New Testament. We'll also be working this time not from the Hebrew and the Aramaic, but from the Greek. One significant difference between Matthew and the Old Testament is noticeable, say, when you compare Matthew with Esther, where God is never mentioned, and with the Song of Solomon, where God is never mentioned. Would you say God is mentioned occasionally in the Gospel of Matthew? Just a glance through it, we have three more Gospels to come, and there are many similarities. In order to note the similarities and the differences, it's very helpful to have what's called a harmony. If you want a harmony of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, one very good one that I used a great deal in class is called A Harmony of the Gospels for Students, based upon the Revised Standard Version. There are others than this. I don't know whether it's on for sale any longer, but you go to a Christian bookstore, you'll find harmonies of the four Gospels. And when they're laid side by side, you can see how often they're the same, how often they're different in very interesting manners. Even in the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000, little details. The first three Gospels, which are sometimes called the Synoptics because they're so similar, I have it in Goodspeed's Greek New Testament. Burton and Goodspeed put these three side by side in the Greek, where we can really check more precisely. If you look at one of these harmonies, and the easiest is to do the one in Greek, you'll notice how much of Mark is in the others, particularly in Matthew and Luke. And one very prevalent understanding is that Mark was first, and we'll discuss the idea that Mark wrote out Peter's gospel. And then Matthew and Luke use Mark along with other sources as they develop their own accounts. Matthew is written by a Jew, for the Jews, and he seems to be primarily concerned, as some see it, to prove that Jesus, when he came, was the promised Messiah, the king of the kingdom that was promised to David. And so, not surprisingly, Matthew is full of Old Testament quotations. Some have counted 60 there. At least Matthew was very concerned, as many Christians were, to tie the New Testament to the Old Testament, or that is to say, the teachings of Christianity, the teachings of Christ. There wasn't a New Testament yet, to tie this into the Old Testament. You note, for one thing, the fulfillment of prophecies. They start right away, don't they, in the first few chapters. But what did you think about some of those predictions right there at the beginning? Not to lose sight, by the way, more than ever before, of our major concern is, what picture of God do you see? There's so many interesting historical and even technical and literary details we could get involved in. We'll need to remind ourselves of what the whole purpose is. Maybe Hebrews 1:1 should stay in mind frequently. In many and various ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by the Son. Now these four Gospels talk about the Son. And the Son says, as recorded in John, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you trust me, you trust the Father. So as we see him described here in Matthew, do you find him someone you could trust, someone you could admire? Because if so, he says, if you admire me, you admire the Father. The Father is just like me. But some of these predictions right at the very first. What about in 2:15? A prediction right there at the beginning, trying to tie the Old Testament to the New, and this would serve to remind us of the times we spent in the Old Testament. What about Matthew 2:15? You remember when Jesus came back from Egypt, when Herod died, and it says, he remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt have I called my son. What did you think of that?
I looked it up, and I felt that it was, it was sort of a free translation, I thought. A free quotation, a paraphrase.
It says, was fulfilled what was spoken. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken. Doesn't that sound as if then, it's Hosea 11:1, isn't it? Was a prediction that this would happen to Jesus. Do you remember in the setting there in Hosea 11? We made much of that chapter, you recall. In fact, that's one place where we use Phillips. I didn't bring my Phillips Old Testament. But looking here in my Revised Standard, Hosea 11:1, and it says, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son, or called him to be my son. And then you read the next sentence. But the more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning incense to idols. Is that what the Messiah was going to do? Is this a prediction of that? So what is the meaning of this fulfilled? Because it's going to come up several times, isn't it, in Matthew? When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called him to be my son. And that's a prediction of Jesus' return from Egypt after the death of Herod. What would that mean?
Not to complicate the issue more, but as I was reading through this time, I looked back to the Old Testament to look up all of the references that Matthew quoted.
Yes.
And the one about the virgin also, which we've covered earlier, I thought was somewhat of a stretch, because that was talking about Isaiah's wife having a child.
Now, that's probably the most important prediction right here, isn't it? And that's mentioned in chapter 1, 23. Well, beginning with verse 18, now the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way, explaining that the baby would be conceived of the Holy Spirit. Verse 21, she will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. And those are the words there, aren't they? In Isaiah 7:14. And by the way, the word for virgin here is the Greek parthenos. Did you include that in your medical terminology, parthenogenesis, virgin birth, and so on? Not that you see many cases of that, I'm sure. It says virgin here, whereas, as you remember, in the Hebrew of Isaiah, the Hebrew word can mean generally a woman of marriageable age, virgin or not, married or not. This took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Do you think the king, when he received that prediction, was aware this was a messianic prediction? Or did he look for some such birth at the very time as a sign that the siege at the hands of Kings Rezin and Pekah would be lifted pretty soon? And you remember as we ran on, there was a baby born right there and then. How could Matthew do this? Yes.
Well, I do have a Jewish physician to work that he and I discuss frequently. He wants to talk about the issue of Christ a lot. Yeah. And when I would bring up things like this to him, he'd say, well, let's go back and look. it's clear from the context that the prophet wasn't referring to this at all.
Yeah.
And you lose ground with the Jewish folks by showing them these. You don't gain ground.
Yeah.
They feel you're twisting and contorting the Old Testament to try to support Christ. Christ's messiahship, I should say.
Now, that then would be quite a hindrance in our thinking that in many and various ways God spoke to the fathers by the prophets. That's the Old Testament. We're all together now with our Jewish friends. But in his last days, he spoke to us by a son who will say, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And we've now come to the beginning of the records of the life of this one. And immediately, some of our Jewish friends would say, I don't have confidence in this record right off. Look at this use of the Old Testament. This is stretching it too far. Then they can't go on to the clarification of the New Testament. Presumably, according to Hebrews 1:1, in these last days he has spoken to us by his Son, is going to be the clearest revelation of all. Then he's immediately turned off page one. Because of the use of Isaiah 7:14, what should one do? Do you remember when we went through the Isaiah 7:7, 8, and 9, we noticed that the sign was obviously for the king, that the siege would be lifted soon. Before the child could say, my father or my mother, the siege would be lifted. And it was lifted. The siege was lifted soon thereafter, and the only baby that's mentioned right in the setting is Mahershalal Hashbaz, who would appear to be Mrs. Isaiah's child, perhaps, because he says, I went into the prophetess, and I hope it was Isaiah's wife, and it does seem to be their baby. And a little later, Isaiah says, behold, my children are for signs. You remember, he had Shear Jashub as well, who was a sign, and now Mahershalal Hashbaz. But that isn't the end. One should always read on. You remember, if you go right from 7 into 8 and then into 9, there's another baby right there. And this baby is not called Mahershalal Hashbaz. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And that's not Mahershalal Hashbaz. It seemed to suggest that there's a much more important baby coming. Is there a parallel? The baby that was born when Isaiah was there was an indication that God was with them. That's the meaning of Emmanuel. God was with them. He hadn't abandoned them. He would rescue them from this siege. But it went from that baby at that time to a much more important baby later on. It would be none other than God, Mighty God, Everlasting Father. And then you remember we looked at some other parallels to see if the Bible does this sort of thing. And you remember how the Prince of Tyre seems to become Lucifer, the adversary, and the king of Babylon seems to become more important. There seems to be a pattern of doing this kind of thing. It would seem to me a great invitation to Matthew to say, well, there is a very interesting parallel here. But as far as the virgin birth is concerned, not only is the word here parthenos, which means only virgin, but the baby was born of the Holy Spirit, very specifically. It doesn't say here that Isaiah went to the prophetess. It doesn't say Joseph went in to Mary and the baby was born. It says this baby would be conceived of the Holy Spirit. So it nails it down as virgin birth. Which, how else could you have Mighty God, Everlasting Father, born on this earth, but in some such way? So it seems to me if you read Isaiah 7, 8, and 9 as the background for Matthew 1, it's not so difficult. Is there an interesting parallel there with out of Egypt have I called my son? That's just, was it a prediction? But what would the word fulfill mean? Fulfill mean? Maybe we should just read on and see if we can find some more. What about 2:18? A voice was heard in Ramah, this is Matthew, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they were no more. Where does that come from?
Jeremiah. And when I looked it up, that one confused me.
It doesn't refer to the babies being killed in Bethlehem either, though there is a significant parallel that might be drawn. Are there any more like this? Well, what about Jesus saying, I've not come to destroy the law and the prophets, I've come to fulfill them? There we have it again. Fulfill all the predictions So we should watch that as we go along. Interestingly, since we're here at the beginning of Matthew, you notice where the genealogy begins. It goes back to Abraham. Further evidence that a Jew writing to Jews. Now, in Luke, the physician, he was a Greek. And where do you suppose he would start? He goes back to Adam for the whole human race. Lots of little details like that. And then the differences in the genealogies, you can read commentaries on some of those differences. But getting back to our main subject now, what do you learn about God from all of this? When you think of all the, let's say the problem stories in the Old Testament that led us to discuss their possible meaning and what they would say about God, we ventured to suggest solutions to some of those problems, like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and so on. Does our coming to the New Testament indicate that we were moving in the right direction? Take one good case, for example, divorce. Look at 5:31. It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But, I say, is he correcting the Old Testament? But even when we were in the Old Testament, Malachi said, I hate divorce. But Moses says, you may give your wife a writ of divorcement. Do you remember our discussion then? Well, what about reading on in Matthew and coming to 19, where Jesus deals with this more thoroughly than he does with most of these problems and gives us the key maybe to all the rest of them? In 19:3, the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by saying, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? Note, testing him. He answered, have you not read that he who made them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh? So they are no longer two but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And at many, many weddings, those are the words that we love to repeat. They said to him, why? If only they had done this more frequently. This time they did it. Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? It sounds like a contradiction coming up. He said to them, and the versions are going to vary here, you've got some extra ones there, Living and New International and New English. Is that the old one or the new one? All right. For your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. What do you have for hardness of heart? Remember we discussed hardening of heart several times in the Old Testament. 19.
Because you are so hard to teach.
What version is that?
The Good News.
The Good News. I like that very much. Because you were so hard to teach. I have jotted another version down. I can't remember which it was, because your minds were closed. What do you have in yours? What's Living?
Living says, Jesus replied, Moses did that in recognition of your hard and evil hearts, but it was not what God had originally intended.
Is yours different, Connie?
Well, I have here the New International, and it says, because your hearts were hard.
Yeah, the New International tries to stay, you know, as literal as possible. What do you have, Dana?
In the New English Bible, it says, your minds were closed.
Oh, there, you've got it. That's the one I wanted. Your minds were closed. Okay, that's the New English. It's interesting, that's the more recent version, because my old New English doesn't say it that way. Sometimes, even without announcing a new edition, they will make some little changes. Well, now, what would you understand that to mean? What about some of the other commands in the Old Testament? How about when you go to war, kill the women, kill the babies, leave alive nothing that breathes? And couldn't we say, why? I mean, in the same vein here, why would you, gentle Jesus, ask them to do that? And why would you order the stoning of Achan, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Why would you drown all but eight? They did at least do it here. Is it because maybe they had some personal involvement in this? I mean, is it okay to divorce wives? Because you read on, the disciples said to him, we should read 9 first. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery. The disciples said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is not expedient to marry. That is, if you can't divorce your wife, who's going to risk getting married? So, I mean, even the disciples, Peter maybe, I don't know how he got along with his wife. He's suggesting here that if you cannot divorce, except for unfaithfulness, it would be better not to marry. Now, how does that come in the versions?
If this is how it is between a man and his wife, it is better not to marry.
It's better
not to marry.
That's
good news.
And when it says, if this is how it is, it means if you can only divorce her for unchastity. The Living Bible must have something colorful on that one.
Jesus' disciples then said to him, if that is how it is better not to marry.
If you can't divorce the wife, it's better not to marry.
New English says it is better not to marry.
Again. I didn't look at Phillips here, but... of course, can you imagine how some of the modern, very paraphrastic ones would have very colorful renderings of this? I think I recall one says, who would dare to marry? If you can't divorce your wife, who would dare to marry? It doesn't say that what wife would marry her husband if she cannot divorce him, you notice. It's what man would risk marrying a woman if he can only divorce her in case of unchastity. Because in those days, if you found your wife unsuitable, it was not too difficult to divorce, and that's why Moses instituted the writ of divorcement, because it was so unfair to the women. I mean, at least this had to be formalized, that she had been your wife, and you found her unacceptable, and you're sending her out. At least she may carry a writ of divorcement. I used to be the wife of Rabbi so-and-so, and he found me unsuitable. There's the question. Why, then, the writ at all, in the first place? Why did Moses permit this? And some would say, well, that's the law of Moses. Do you remember the end of Leviticus? It doesn't say that it was just the law of Moses. It's important that we can remember now everything we read back in the Old Testament, lest we say, Moses said this, but I say, you see. You remember at the end of Leviticus, after all those rules and regulations, these are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. Did Moses make up these rules? So then the question is correctly, why then would you tell Moses to allow us to divorce our wives? Why would you do that? And he said, because of the stiffness of your neck and the hardness of your heart. Yes, Jenny.
Did they have a high divorce rate then? I wonder if...
Of course, I don't know statistically. That's one to look up.
I wonder if it's so different now than it was then.
I've never seen that reduced statistic. I wonder if anybody has done it. It was an attempt to curb it that led to the law that God gave to Moses that there must be a writ of divorcement. You would consider it more seriously, and it would reduce it. But Jesus is reducing it still further and says only for that one reason. In fact, if you do it for any other reason, you're putting your wife in the position, your former wife, of committing adultery if she marries again and so on. What do you think, though, with respect to our question, what does this all say about God, of what's intimated here, that this regulation, which you, my own disciples, apparently seem to appreciate, that you have permission, if your wives don't please you, to give them a writ of divorcement. His explanation is, I still agree with what inspired Malachi to write. I hate divorce. But I permitted this because you were so hard to teach. Does that say anything? As we look back at the entire Old Testament. Now think of some other things that we may have wondered about in the Old Testament.
When he originally said to sacrifice, and then how many times have we read it throughout the Bible? I don't want your sacrifices.
So why did I give you that whole bloody system?
And stoning someone who worked on the Saturday, on Sabbath, seemed a little harsh at the time.
Yeah.
One Israelite was out picking up some sticks to make a fire on Sabbath, and they stoned him.
Yeah. So why did I have to have such harsh, apparently harsh, rules and regulations? Well, we're coming to the Sermon on the Mount here, which is so gentle and gracious. God, why didn't you talk to us like that on Mount Sinai? You might have had a great revival. You know, you'd have touched our hearts instead of scaring us. Though he said you were so hard to teach. That's why I raised my voice at the time. Think of many other stories in the Old Testament that might apply here.
Well, Elisha with the she-bears that had to come out and kill those children.
Why would gentle Jesus send she-bears? Because you didn't revere me unless I also mixed it with a great deal of fear and terror, and I hated to do that. When you mentioned, say, the whole sacrificial system, Paul is going to raise this question a little later, isn't he? Why then the law? And he doesn't seem to divide it between the Ten Commandment law and the ceremonial law. It just seems to be, why then the whole legal system? Why would you do that? If you want us to be free and to love and trust and have joy and peace, or things you cannot command, why then the law? And when you think of the fact that the whole ceremonial system was very symbolic, and symbolism is dark speech. You think back to Numbers, where God said, when I talk to prophets, even, I talk in dark speech, symbols, pictures, figures, ceremonies. But when I talk to Moses, I don't talk to him like that. I talk simply and plainly. And the people could have said, why don't you talk to us all simply and plainly? He said, I can only talk to Moses that way because he is my friend. And so a little later in John, he's going to say, I call you rather my friends because I want you to understand. And immediately thereafter, he said, let me tell you plainly about the Father. And he made that simple statement. I make no promise to you that I will intercede with the Father for you, for the Father loves you himself. Which seemed to do away with the whole priestly intercession system of the Old Testament. They could have said, well, why? And they didn't. They did it here on divorce. I guess that meant more to them, you know. But why then did you give the whole system of apparent priestly intercession, this whole company of priests and all the rites and the rituals and the shedding of blood and so, why did you give us all that if the Father loves us as much as you and there is no need? And they didn't ask. Once again, they were concerned about personal matters, material things. What positions will we hold in the kingdom? Preoccupied them. And even here, they really weren't asking about God. Or they would have pursued the question. His answer was, because of the stiffness of your necks and the hardness of your hearts. And they didn't say, are you trying to tell us that God will use emergency measures from time to time? Things he would rather not do? He would permit divorce, though he hated divorce? Lord, could that apply to our request for a king? And you said, you won't want one, it won't be good for you. But we begged. And you said, all right, I'll pick one for you. And when we didn't like the food of the manna, the food of angels, and we begged for the food of Egypt, and you said, all right, you can have it. They could have gone down a list so long, Matthew would have been a whole lot longer. And they wasted the opportunity. Then wouldn't it be our privilege now to do exactly what they did regarding divorce? Why? And we won't hear, though, a direct reply. Or is it somewhere in there? Could we apply the same principle, at least? How many things did he direct? How many commandments and laws did he give? Because we were so hard to teach. And later, Paul is really going to take that up with the Galatians, and interestingly enough, involved with the whole matter of circumcision. God, why would you use something like that? So there's an invitation, isn't there, rather early here in Matthew, to do this thing we've been trying to do, but now we do it right in the New Testament. What about another one here in 5:38? You have heard that it was said, which sounds like an invitation to say, now this is the way it used to be, but let me clear this up. This is not really right. Is he even correcting the Old Testament? Let alone is he contradicting the Old Testament. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And so on for the paragraph. Would that mean that the picture of God in the Old Testament, it's suggested right here by Jesus himself, would be very obscure? Because in the Old Testament, you'll find that kind of a thing, and a God who would say, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is certainly not equal to the God who would say, turn the other cheek. Is he suggesting, thereby, that the picture in the Old Testament is not that clear? Or what do you think of a God who would say to the people at that time, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth?
But maybe it was better than what they were doing at the time. It
was
appropriate for the time. Well, they were going all out revenge, doing far beyond what had been done to them.
Yeah, you remember the cities of refuge they had to have so you could run until there was some thought given to the to who was the criminal. Is this another case of God meeting people where they are?
You change the rules for a 2-year-old or a 13-year-old.
Yeah. Now, how many other things can we apply that to in the Old Testament?
I think you always have to look at what the setting was.
Yeah.
And how God was dealing with them at that time.
Does that make God seem rather undependable and flexible? And don't you want one who'll take a stand?
But we do that as
rigidly,
parents.
Immovably. Because what is God immovably committed to, apparently, throughout the scriptures? What seems to be his goal?
Winning people and keeping them.
Can you win people without communicating with them?
Mm-mm.
Can you win people if you can't even get their attention? Can you win people if they're so busy slaughtering each other? Think, may I have your attention for a moment? If you swap the Mount of Olives for the Mount Sinai and have God coming down gently on the top of the Mount of Olives there with the tribes all around misbehaving the way they were and starting out, blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor, can you imagine them listening? People who are prone to dancing around the golden calf. I rather suspect we all admire this in God very, very much, but some people rather don't, and some even find it very distressing that God would be this way. In what way is it admirable, do you think, and trustworthy to watch God meeting people where they are, and if need be, sending she bears, and opening up the ground, and thundering on Sinai, and allowing writs of divorcement, and then coming along and saying, I actually hate divorce. What do you mean you hate divorce? You gave us permission to divorce. I still hate it. I hate the whole idea of monarchy, but you gave us monarchy. I don't like the fighting, but you helped us fight. In fact, you inspired David to write psalms of praise and gratitude. Thank you for strengthening me that I could thrust my enemies through. And God could say, look, every time that you sang that psalm down there, we winced up in heaven. You were saying amen, and we were saying, oh dear, Then why would the Holy Spirit inspire David to thank God for strength to thrust his enemies through? Would there be any way to take a verse here and a verse there and really construct an adequate understanding of what God is like? Doesn't one really need the entire setting? And the more we can know about the whole historical setting, the better, which is our privilege today, where we have scholars in many different lines of biblical research coming up with all this information. We've never been in a better position to reconstruct the setting within which God so spoke and so acted. But then the question is, ultimately, do you like this kind of a God? If everybody knew what God is really like, would they like him? I mean, it's no guarantee, is it, that we'll love and trust him because we see him as he really is. In fact, do you find, I don't want to sound as if we're assuming, of course, that we're absolutely right, that something you admire the most about God, some people will say, that's what I like the least about him. So everybody's free to be persuaded in his own mind. Yeah, Jane.
Well, just as we were talking about, if someone slaps you, turn the other cheek.
Yeah.
Well, some people might think, well, if I continue to do that, how does evil stop? Mm-hmm. If he sues me for the shirt on my back and I give him my coat and then he wants my home, I mean, people are going to say, how can we do that? I like it better, an eye for an eye, they might want to say, because at least they're being punished for what they did.
Now, I heard a theologian say, and he had company around him agreeing with him, that the total basis, the fundamental basis of God's government of the universe is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Justice. Justice.
Well, I think that if you see someone that is kind like that, that can take a blow and turn their cheek, that it touches people in such a way, but not everyone. I guess you can't help that, though.
It was
touches
predicted.
Like people.
Yeah.
What?
It touches like people.
That's an interesting point. That should lead us later into discussion of the fact that when Jesus taught, he taught with authority, but not in the customary way. But did he speak with authority to everybody? No, many despised what he said, but some. It registered with some. So that depends on the individual, as you're saying. Yeah.
I read a essay one time on Gandhi, and I guess Gandhi had read the story of Christ, and he had, you know, if your enemy slaps, you turn the other cheek, and that was the basis, or at least partially the basis, for his nonviolent confrontation of the British in India,
yeah.
And they won. It was, if they never could have caught the British out of India had they taken up arms, because the British were so superiorly armed than they were, but they did the nonviolent approach, and it was much stronger than guns.
Though at the time, you have to wait a long time sometimes for that to work. Because some like the thought that if somebody hits you on the cheek, you turn the other one. Then when you've turned both cheeks, then you're free. You only have to do the two. You remember the disciples asked, how many times should we forgive? And you remember the response, 70 times 7, which is almost suggesting there's no end to it. Well, as he commented on, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, in a way, was part of their law, part of their system. He even in 43 says, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Where's that? But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Would that be very popular in the days when the Romans were in charge? Love the Romans. Pray for the Romans when they persecute you, and so on. Were they looking for a Messiah? We talked a little bit about this when we just glanced at some of the intertestamental literature. Were they looking for someone who would come and tell them to love the Romans? And if a Roman asks for your cloak, give him your undergarment also. Give him something else as well. Here it is. If anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. I mean, this is no way to establish the kingdom, is it? Because the kingdom of God is not like the kingdom of men. It just didn't make sense to them. They'd waited all this time for the promised one. Of course, they had not read Isaiah 53, which suggested he would be despised as pertaining to the Messiah. I mean, not many did. So when Jesus came and was despised, they didn't say, oh, that fulfills Isaiah 53. Many devout Jewish scholars think that the suffering servant is Judaism itself, that they have, and they have indeed suffered. There's no question about it. But he didn't seem to fit. You can imagine that these teachings would not appeal to to Saul, who later became Paul. And he was prepared to offer, you know, really strong leadership and was the number one representative of the Sanhedrin. It would appear their great evangelist to go out and do away with sin and do away with sinners and heretics too. And he had heard about this gentle heretic Jesus who on the cross said, Father, forgive them. And then he watched Stephen while Stephen was being stoned saying, don't put this to their account. I mean, what is this? I mean, is this any way to support the truth and support God in the world, to be so gentle and submissive? All it does is result in your death. At the end of your ministry, Stephen died, Jesus died. So how would you expect God to meet Saul on the Damascus Road to make the point that that is the way in the long run to build the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of freedom and love and peace and trust and so on? And so he tapped Saul on the shoulder, which, Bob, you know very well, since you were the model for the picture of Saul on the Damascus Road in the book Servants Are Friends. Instead of tapping you on the shoulder and saying, could I have a word with you? Could we discuss this matter? Blessed are the meek, and so on. He floored you on the Damascus Road and got your attention, as wonderfully pictured in that painting. He got his attention. But we need to save that for the book of Acts. God is still doing this thing. He's meeting people where they are. If you need a little Sinai rather than the gentle Mount of Olives, you might have a little Sinai first. But he transferred Saul to the Mount of Olives rather quickly, didn't he? And he got the message. But as you read through all this, you have heard that it was said, but I say, wouldn't that seem to be contradicting, or at least correcting, the Old Testament? And those to whom the Scriptures meant everything, I mean, they almost treated them, well, you remember the reverence with which an Orthodox Jew, a fundamentalist Jew, treats the Scriptures this day. I mean, physically, the respect they show. For Jesus to get up and say, you have heard that it was said in these scrolls, but I say, I mean, and this is his beginning of his ministry. He's announcing himself as an arch-heretic right off, that he's not in harmony with Scripture. So naturally, 517 came up before some of this, to help them, to prepare them. Think not that I've come to abolish what you have in these scrolls. Think not that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot. Do you have jot or tittle, King James? Or a dotting of an I or the crossing of a T? Anyway, it's very, very small. What do you have there in 518?
Not the least point.
Not the least point. That's really what it means, isn't it? Not the least point will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Now, is that referring only to the Ten Commandments? That's commonly done by those who have a great burden to preserve the continuing authority of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, down to the present time. And so they like to use this verse, particularly they like to use just 18. For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not a jot, not a tittle will pass from the Ten Commandments, till all is accomplished, thereby depriving themselves of something of very great value. He's not talking about the Ten Commandments alone. Look at 17. Think not that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. And I don't know whether we've discussed this before. We certainly will when we get to Luke, where Jesus said, everything written about me in the law, the prophets, and the Psalms, the law, the prophets, and the holy writings will be fulfilled. And this would be familiar to the Jews. They had developed sort of a triple division of the Old Testament collection of books. The law was Moses, the Pentateuch. The prophets, and we could list the books that were in the prophets. Some of those are quite historical. And then the holy writings would be like the Psalms particularly. So sometimes, since the Psalms were the dominant book in that third collection, it would be called the Law, the Prophets, and the Psalms. But that's a long reference to the Old Testament, so sometimes it was the Law and the Prophets. Sometimes just the Law. A little later on, Jesus is going to say, does it not say in your law? And he quotes the Psalms. So in verse 18, nothing will pass from the Old Testament. Would be better. The whole thing. I've not come to do away with the Old Testament. He subscribed to Hebrews 1:1, not yet written. In many and various ways, God spoke to the fathers by the prophets. The whole Old Testament. But in these last days, the Son has come not to do away with what God said to the prophets, but to fulfill. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these commandments, and we think immediately of the Decalogue, no, and teaches men so, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. So then he comes down to 21, you have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. All right, that's the Decalogue. But we've read on down to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and that's not in the Decalogue. And then they brought up the matter of the divorce laws. So they understood it as really all the teachings of the Old Testament. Jesus didn't cancel the old. He rather said on the road to Emmaus, everything written about me will be fulfilled. Yes.
Why so many times does it say that people will be thrown into hell?
Oh, the references to hell in here? You might want to compare the versions, by the way, on that, because sometimes you'll see grave instead. Sometimes you may even see the word Gehenna in there, which is familiar from the Old Testament as that garbage dump that was burning all the time and where the worms were always working. However, it seems pretty fiery at times, doesn't it? If your hand offends you, cut it off. It would be better to go to heaven without a hand than to go to hell, and so on. If you put all those together, does it rather confirm the idea that there is a place where immortal souls go for eternal torment?
No, I didn't read that it said immortal souls.
Yes.
But
pick a verse.
Well,
particularly.
Matthew 5.
5.
29.
29. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And my footnote has Greek Gehenna. And that was that familiar garbage dump outside Jerusalem. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell.
Then why didn't these translations do a better job of the word?
How does yours read?
Hell. And even over in 5:22, where it says, if you call your brother a worthless fool, you will be in danger of going to the fire of hell.
And then it says fire.
Mm-hmm.
How are your versions reading, Bob? Any better?
5:22 reads, but I have added to that rule, I tell you that if you are not only angry, even in your own home, you are in danger of judgment. If you call your friend an idiot, you are in danger of being brought before the court.
Yes.
And if you cursed him, you are in danger of the fires of hell.
Yeah. Even if you say, you fool, you shall be liable to the hell of fire.
Mine says hell in both verses.
Hell in both places. Nobody has any other rendering of that. I should have brought my 26 versions into one. Now, your question about it is, why so many references to hell?
Someone told me that Jesus himself speaks of hell.
Yes.
So, I can see where...
He speaks of Gehenna.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks of the grave. Now, when the person makes the observation, Jesus speaks of hell... The person raising the question or making the comment is assuming that hell means...
immortal.
Thus and so.
Mm-hmm.
So he is assuming that when Jesus mentions hell, Jesus is speaking of the place of eternal torment where immortal souls will suffer. Now, Jesus does use the word that's translated hell, but what does that word mean?
Land of the dead, or...
Yeah.
The grave, or...
What about this this place? Now, not to get too involved in just this, except that if God has a place like that, we need to keep that in mind when we read all this about love and peace and freedom and there's no need to be afraid and so on. If there is a place like that, if you call your brother a fool, you know what God does? This is the kind of God he is. You are in danger of a hell of fire. It's whoever says you're a fool. Do you remember in the Old Testament, but it's Isaiah again, isn't it? They look out from the walls, and what will they see? Oh, we touched on it back there. Because this would be the background for any reference in the New Testament to Gehenna and so on, wouldn't it be? Look at Isaiah 66:24, for example. A sentence that's often used to describe what he means by this fiery hell, this Gehenna. They shall go forth and look on the writhing bodies of the men that have rebelled against me. It says, the dead bodies. The dead. So one would want to discuss right there with the individual who is assuming that hell means a place where immortally living people suffer. You wouldn't want to then use this in the Old Testament, would you? Because here they're dead. They're corpses.
Doesn't it say somewhere that only God is immortal? And then...
Yet you can take that whole subject of the immortality.
And when he raises, when the good come up... they will be made immortal, but I don't remember reading that it said the evil would be made immortal. Is that correct?
That the evil will receive immortality?
Right.
Don't you find a verse that says that?
No,
if you find it, do let us know. I wouldn't want to overlook that. But when you look at Malachi, the end of the Old Testament, which is so close to the New, to Matthew, you notice in 4, at the end, when things are so good for the righteous, the day that comes shall burn them up. Well, let's start with 4:1. For behold, the day comes, burning like an oven, when all the arrogant and all evildoers, doesn't that sound like the people described in Matthew, will be stubble. The day that comes shall burn them up, says the Lord of hosts, so that it will leave them neither root nor branch. And then, verse 3, and you shall tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes. We've got corpses in Isaiah, and we've got ashes here. So what is this hell of fire? Well, a little later, Jesus is going to talk about the story of the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And that maybe needs to be included as a possibility here for consideration. He said, once upon a time, and you know he was going to begin one of his parables, it would seem, the rich man died and went to hell, and the poor man died and went to heaven, to the bosom of Abraham, and they were able to communicate back and forth. And you remember in the story that the rich man who was suffering so at least would appreciate a cool drink. And he asked that the poor man might beseech the heavenly authorities to send a little drink down to him in hell. Now, if you can imagine this being literally so, certainly it would evaporate before it got down there. And is there communication between the two and so forth and so on? Why would Jesus tell that story?
Well,
if it wasn't meant to confirm there is a place where the wicked suffer for eternity in hell and will be calling to the saints who evidently can see them, raising questions about there'll be no more tears. If you saw your husband down there suffering for all eternity, could you be happy? I guess some could. Some say that would really confirm my joy if for eternity I could see that rascal getting what he so richly deserved. I hope not to live next door to someone like that. The whole thing seems so much like a parable, you wonder why any of it is taken literally. But Jesus did run the risk of talking about hell as a place of burning, where people go and suffer. How should we use that? Did some of them believe that at the time? Do we have other examples where he would, without correcting some of their beliefs, would actually be, what's a careful word to use, wanting to communicate with them? He would, without correcting their beliefs, act in a way that used their beliefs, even though they weren't true, to make a point. What I'm thinking of is, he raised Lazarus, again it's Lazarus, but a different one, the brother of Mary and Martha, on the fourth day. Why did he wait till the fourth day? Some of them believed that the spirit, the soul, hovered around for 3 days, and then having found that obviously there was going to be no revival, departed. And when Jesus had resurrected Jairus' daughter, they had tried to suggest it was a fake, that she was only asleep. So this time, he waits until the most skeptical person in the audience would agree that Lazarus is dead. And then the clincher is, when he said, remove the stone, they said, please don't do it, he stinks. He said, all right, anybody here going to suggest that Lazarus isn't dead? And they all agreed he was dead. Then the resurrection was unanswerable. But it isn't because he believed the soul hovered nearby, it's because they believed it. And he met them where they were. And I think we see, just as in the Old Testament, God met them where they were. I see Jesus meeting people where they are with the beliefs that they held. We're going to run into an interesting one where Paul argues for the resurrection by saying, why do you get baptized for the dead? 1 Corinthians 15:29. Why do you get baptized for the dead if you don't believe the dead arise? Does that mean that he believed you should get baptized for the dead? Or is this another example of taking people's beliefs and working within that framework for a while as you seek later on to correct it? Doesn't he do that all the time? How about the whole sacrificial system in the Old Testament? It was not unique, you know. He took a system that was not too different. He built them a tabernacle. It was not too strange. He dressed the priests in garments. Not too strange. Again, meeting them where they were and gave them something to begin with. What about all these references to hell? Many of them believed in it. And he says it would be much better to cut your hand off and go to heaven without a hand than to keep it and go to hell as a whole person. Was he They're giving a definitive statement on the existence of a terrible place where the fire burns forever and immortal souls go. When he has already in the Old Testament referred to ashes, stubble, corpses, wouldn't one have to put all of those together? What about right here in the Sermon on the Mount, right at the very beginning? In 5:21, he says, I haven't come to destroy the Old Testament, I've come to fulfill. 5:21, you have heard that it was said to the men of old, you shall not kill, and whoever kills shall be liable to judgment. But you shall not kill, that's in the Decalogue, isn't it? Is he going to improve on the Decalogue? But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother, whoever insults his brother, is that contradicting that commandment or enlarging on it? But had not Moses already done it? I mean, hadn't Moses already said, and do not hate your brother in your heart? He'd already done that. If they had read more widely, too often when we think of the commandments, we think of the ten on the wall, you know. But there was a lot more around this to help us understand what those ten on the wall really meant. Like in the fourth one on the Sabbath, if we count that as the four, you shall do no work. What is work? And his disciples rubbed some kernels of corn, grain in their hands, and they had defined that as work. And he did not condemn their doing it. So he's come to explain. Is that part of the meaning of fulfill, Mary? To fill up its meaning, perhaps? What about in 27? You have heard that it was said you shall not commit adultery, but I say everyone who wants to. But that's even in the Decalogue. That's in number 10, which says thou shalt not have any evil desire. It was already in there. So when he says, but I say, he's not correcting what was already said. He was saying, but let me tell you how much that means. It means a lot more than actually committing adultery. It means wanting to do it. So this matter of fulfill is not just the fulfillment of a prediction, but it means almost filling up the meaning, enlarging on it, helping you understand it. Would that seem to be fair? I've come to explain the real purpose and the real meaning. And Leviticus and Deuteronomy were so clear on that, that to keep the Ten Commandments is to love the Lord with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself, and not even to hate your neighbor in your heart, is as old as Moses and the giving of the Ten. So, well, some history in here. The attempt to kill Jesus. This is not the first time there's been a slaughter of innocents, is there? You think of Egypt and the killing of the baby boys? Would you see any parallels there? And might that even, the interesting parallels there, have led Matthew to think of, out of Egypt have I called my son, in Hosea, being usable here as a parallel? When they were in Egypt looking for someone to lead them out, or at least for rescue, who in particular would not want the children of Abraham to be rescued from Egyptian bondage and returned to the promised land that God's plan announced to Abraham might continue? And that brings up the whole war, doesn't it, that began up in heaven. And Satan trying to thwart God's plan, which would seem to require a leader to lead them out of Egypt, and there was a decree to kill all the baby boys. Now, here, it's time for the Messiah to be born, to institute a new period, and there's another decree to kill the baby boys. The parallels are very interesting, aren't they? So I see more parallels than the fulfillment of a prediction, a remarkable parable, the same God at work. And when he sought to prepare baby Moses to be the leader, there was a decree to kill all those baby boys, and God worked marvelously to preserve Moses, that he might be able to call his people out of Egypt.